Hello and thank you for joining us in Mapping the Zone, a podcast that's usually dedicated to highly fixated reviews of usually large, dense books. This time, not the works, or really, but kind of context of Thomas Pynchon. I'm Will, I'm one of the co-hosts, and today I have, as alluded to many weeks ago now at this point from your future perception listener, as Cody referenced, I am here to pitch you on a novel, one that many of you may have heard about, many of you may be aware of, but in all likelihood, none of you have heard about. And so, here is my quick short pitch before I get into the meat of things. But this time, for once, I don't have a lot of theories or ideas to share with you. I'm just going to give you some connective piece summaries and read a lot of the book. But do you like Blazing Saddles? Do you like voodoo? Do you like jazz and abstract art? If so, boy, have I got a book for you. And that book is Yellowback Radio Broke Down by Ishmael Reed.
Oh, yeah.
Now, Cody is saying yeah there, because a few weeks ago, in one of our final episodes covering Bleeding Edge, I went on a pretty excited rant about how much I enjoyed the book. And this is going to be a continuation of that little conversation we had. Now, just to get it out of the way, this is a book that is, I will say, very insensitive. Now, as a result, there are many passages that I think are great highlights of the writing style and the humor that I don't have an issue with them in the context of the book. I would rather not run into the possibility of getting hate mail for reading them aloud. So I'm leaving those little nuggets and jewels for the listener to find themselves. Because, first of all, the book is very short. Go read it if I make it sound interesting. And there were some quotes that I felt needed to be read anyway. For some of those words, particularly one that starts with N, I will be substituting it very briefly with, you know, the usual. However, I will say it's pretty well done in the context of the book. If you are not somebody who is deeply disturbed by such language, I recommend you to sally forth regardless. The book opens with, "Folks, this here is the story of the Loop Guru Kid. A cowboy so bad, he made a working posse of spells phone in sick. A bullwhacker so unfeeling, he left the print of winged mice on hides of crawling women. A desperado so ornery, he made the Pope cry and the most powerful of cattlemen shed his head to the executioner's swine. A terrible cuss of a thousand shivs he was who wasted whole herds, made the fruit black and wormy, dried up the water holes, and caused people's eyes to grow from tiny black dots into slapjacks wherever his feet fell. Now, he wasn't always bad, trump over hearts, diamonds, and clubs. Once a wild joker, he cut the fool before bemused Egyptians, dressed like Mortimer Snurd and spilled French fries on his lap at Las Vegas on top of the strip. Booted out of his father's house after a quarrel, horse snapped at his heels, and trick dogs did the fandango on his belly. Men called him brother, only to cop his coin and tell malicious stories about his cleft foot. Born with a caul over his face and ghost lobes on his ears, he was a mean night tripper who moved from town to town, quoting Thomas Jefferson and allowing bandits to build a flop house around his genius. A funny blue hippo who painted himself with water flowers only to be drummed out of each tribe, dressed down publicly, his medals ripped off. Finally, he joined a small circus and happily performed with his fellow 86D. A juggler, a dancing bear, a fast-talking barker, and Zozo the Breek, charter member of the American Hoodoo Church. Their fame spread throughout the frontier, and bouquets of flowers greeted them in every town until they moved into that city, which seemed a section of hell shipped off and shipped upstairs, yellow back radio, where even the sun was afraid to show its bottom. Now that the first walls have been breached, if anyone who listened there is particularly familiar with, I suppose, mystical Christian theology or general mysticism, probably caught that in many ways, the Loop Guru Kid, who is our protagonist of the book, may or may not literally be the devil. Regardless, he is quite a fun fellow, and he is not an anti-hero in any way. He is a genuine hero of this story. The title of the book, Yellowback Radio Broke Down, is an interesting one, which, like many of my favorite titles, can be, I think, recontextualized and broken down a few different ways. But to quote from, well, in my immediate sense, quote from Wikipedia, quoting from an interview, the author, Ishmael Reed, said that he based the book on old radio scripts in which the listener constructed the sets in his imagination. That's why radio, also because it's an oral book, a talking book. There's more dialogue than scenery or description. And I think that's an interesting and an important way to go into Ishmael Reed's novels, of which I've only read two, this and the far more famous and more pension-relevant Mumbo Jumbo, although I hear tell that many people think that Loop Guru Kid appears in Gravity's Rainbow. I don't remember myself. In any case, his artistic philosophy is one that breaks down the pretense of the novel as a format. And so while he says there that a lot of the book is in dialogue, and it certainly is, of note is that there's no quotation, there's not even the Joycean or Gaddis-esque M-dash. There's just, it's inserted inline in a far more chaotic way than, for example, Cormac McCarthy handles dialogue. So it's very easy, while reading the book, to get lost in what is dialogue, what is not, because half the time the narrator is talking directly to you, half the time the characters are talking to you through the narrator, or sometimes you're just not quite sure what's happening, although that is not to its detriment. But as that introduction stated, they enter into the town called Yellowback Radio. And in Yellowback Radio, this circus, this Western circus troupe, finds that there are no adults, and in fact, the children have taken over the town and are holding them at gunpoint. And they say, when asked, "Where did all the adults go?" "We chased them out of town. We were tired of them ordering us around. They worked us day and night in the mines, made us herd animals, harvest the crops, and for 3 hours a day we went to school to hear teachers praise the old. Made us learn facts by rote. Lies really bent upon making us behave. We decided to create our own fiction. One day we found these pearl-shaped pills in a cave of mountain. They're what people ages ago called devil's pills. We put them in the stream so that when the grown-ups went to fill their buckets, they swallowed some. It confused them more than they were, so we moved them and chased them out of town. Good riddance. They listened to this old woman on the talk show who filled their heads with rot. She was against joy and life, the decrepit bag of sticks, and she put them into the same mood. They always demanded we march and fight heathens." "Where are the old people now?" Jake asked. "They're camped out at Drag Gibson's spread. We think they're preparing to launch some kind of invasion, but we're ready for them. Drag just sent his herd up the Chisholm to market yesterday, but there are enough cowpokes left behind to give us a good fight. Our Indian informant out at Drag's spread tells us the townspeople haven't given in to Drag's conditions yet. He wants them to sign over all of their property in exchange for lending his men to drive us out. Then he will not only rule his spread, which is as large as Venezuela, but the whole town as well. He's the richest man in the valley, with prosperous herds, abundant resources, and an ego as wide as the Grand Canyon. This nonsense would never happen in the Seven Cities of Cibola," Jake the Barker said. "The Seven Cities of Cibola," the children asked, moving in closer to Jake's wagon. "Inanimate things. Computers do the work, feed the fowl, and program cows give cartons of milkshakes in 26 flavors. Yippee, the children yelled. Where is it? I think that does a good job of kind of addressing what the attitude of the book is. These are pioneer children, yet they know, you know, about the size of Venezuela. They know about the general political movements of the time. Because this is a book that does not care about reality. This is a book that is about itself. It is a book that is about cultural trends. It's a book that's about religion and economics and politics, but is also primarily, at least in form, about its own world. This is a world with helicopters, but it's the Old West. This is a book with green horses. This is a book with black cowboys who are also Satan, but he's a good guy this time. And what happens there, very briefly, is Drag Gibson's men come out from nowhere and slaughter everyone of note so far in the story, except for the Loop Guru Kid and many of the children. And as the Loop Guru Kid goes off to find, you know, some kind of sanctuary in this very much, if it were a movie, would be called an exploitation movie, a revenge western, at least in terms of the genre itself. He's going off to lick his wounds before coming back to take that revenge. And as he's out in the desert, he's come upon by Bo Schmo and his social realist gang. Bo Schmo did all the thinking for them. Their job was merely to fold their arms and look mean at the hoedowns, or rather the shakedowns. So you see, Bo Schmo was a real collectivist. Worked hard at it. 50 toothbrushes cluttered his bathroom, and when he walked down the street, it seemed a dozen centipedes headed your way. He woke up in the morning with crowds and went to bed with a mob. The man loved company. It seemed that he wore people under his coat, although none of them would pull it for him. He resembled Harpo Marx at times. You know, the scene where Harpo is shoplifted to market and stuffed all the smoked hams under an oversized coat. He looked like that. The trouble with you, Loop, is that you're too abstract, the part-time autocrat, monarchist, and guru finally said. Crazy Dada N-word, that's what you are. You're given to fantasy and are off in matters of detail. Far-out esoteric bullshit is where you're at. Why, in those suffering books that I read about my old neighborhood and how hard it was, every gumdrop machine is in place, while your work is a blur and a doodle. I'll bet you can't create the difference between a German and a redskin. What's your beef with me, Bo Schmo? What if I write circuses? No one says a novel has to be one thing. It can be anything it wants to be. A vaudeville show, 6 o'clock news, the mumblings of wild men saddled by a demon. All art must be for the end of liberating the masses. A landscape is only good when it shows the oppressor hanging from its tree. Right on, Bo, the henchman chorused. Did you receive that in a vision, or was it revealed to you? Look out now, Loop, don't get quippy with me. I'll have one of my men take you off. We can't afford the luxury of individualism getting up our rustling. We blast those who don't agree with us. Ah, leave me alone, Bo Schmo, doing my thing, which for now is dying. You presume to be able to give other people decrees, living in your expensive neo-socialist retreat, while common folk who follow your rants try to match their nickel plates with aeroplanes and tanks. One of these days, those people are going to rise up from the pavement where they died clutching coupons and unredeemable refuse from shop windows and take it out on your hide. Okay, Fat Mouth, you asked for it. Discipline him, fellows. The horsemen dismounted and began to put Loop through changes. Being neo-social realist and not very original, they gave him a version of Arab death. They smeared jelly on his face and buried him up to the neck in desert. Soon his face would be crawling with vermin, which was certainly no picnic of a way to go. Suddenly, above them, a whirring noise. Gads, Bo said, the arch nemesis of villains like me, the flying brush beeve monster. Let's get out of here. The horsemen mounted their nags and, with Bo Schmo out front, headed back to their institution in the mountains. Not only would he be a desert carrion, but now something right out of science fiction was descending upon him from the heavens, Loop thought. At this point, I'm going to stop summarizing quite so much because, again, this is a very short book. The plot is not the point, but I think it's a lot of the pleasure. And from here on, the quotes that I read may be long, but I will not situate them. And I don't think it's all that necessary, because a lot of this book's joy is in those micro details. As that section kind of talks about, so much of this book plays with metafiction in such a loose way that clearly the Loop Guru kid is in that scene at the very least a stand-in for Reed himself being criticized for maybe not himself being criticized for writing abstract anarchist voodoo influenced novels, but you know, it's all there right there at the surface. There's no allegory. What we find throughout this book is that Drag Gibson, as mentioned by the kids, is a ranch owner. He is the primary antagonist. He is, in many ways, the icon of white American imperialism, Western expansion, cultural hegemony. The doctor sat across from Drag. He raised his cup to his lips and spat out the contents. "How many times have I told you I take two lumps in my Java, China boy?" he said, biffing the man on his head with a cane. China boy let loose and splurched the doctor in the smush. "Take that, you solly-looking cleep." "Why, you doctor," said, wiping the crust from his face and reaching for his gun. "I'm going to plug you, you little varmint." "Ha ha, don't let him upset you," Drag consoled. "Let all the little yellow infidels sass you. I run a democratic household. All the oppressed people, those carrying trays, hog sloppers, cow milkers, fruit pickers, and miners are allowed to insult me, like the celebrated N-word dwarf Zip of Barnum Bailey fame. Little minority thought he owned the sideshow and hired everybody in it. Nobody let him know any better. Longest freak show to run in the history of the circus." Because this is not a book that's all about high-minded, abstract things. It's also about the very real, the ways in which people with power keep their power by pretending to cede it. And throughout this book, there's an incredible diversity of nuanced irony and sincere broad statements about these kinds of issues. Where I think the book shines the most is in these moments of intense, very direct and blatant drawing from hoodoo culture, voodoo, however you want to call it, the various religions that come out of West Africa that have been formed through syncretism with Catholicism and Protestantism and various other forms of Christianity or various other North American native religious traditions. One of the things that becomes incredibly clear early on is that the Loop Guru kid is not just Satan, and Satan is not some counterpart to God. He is not just a fallen angel. He is also, at least thanks to his pal right up front, Zozo Lubrik, is a neo-hoodoo priest of a kind, at the very least. Taking a pinch of maize flour from a plate, Loop began to draw on the floor in front of the altar's various symbols associated with the loa he wanted to call. Loop began to shake a rattle slowly. "I, the Father which wert in heaven, conjure and command thee, O Legba, master of the crossroads, to connect this cowboy circuit to Guinea and summon forth cousin Zaka, who will parch their fields and slaughter their livestock and make their herd winding up the Chisholm stumble into a twilight zone. O Gu, rust their firearms and cause their horseshoes to slip off the animals' hooves. O Judas Iscariot, who ratted on the ghoul, give me the treachery, turn this town upside down and spill evil from all of its pockets. O Jack Johnson, give me the power to rise for the bell until Yellow Back Radio is down for the count. O Doc John, Doc Yaya, and Zozo Lubrik, Marie Laveau, the grand improvisers, if I am not performing these rites correctly, send the loa anyway and allow my imagination to fill the gaps. O Mac Hobson, blood of my blood, teach me the secret of the 12 rabbits and the cheesecake. O Baron Lacroix, grip Drag Gibson so that every other day last rites will be requested. O Johnny of the delicate feet, red-eyed Izzily, Marinette of the dry arm, send the dead swiftly to make my vengeance so complete and artsy-craftsy that through that I, though an amateur, will be admired by Hungans the world over. O General Dig, bury drag Gibson in the stomach of wines next to George Wallace. O Black Hawk American Indian Hungan of Hoodoo, please do open up some of these prissy Orthodox minds so that they will no longer call black people's American experience corrupt, perverse, and decadent. Please show them that Booker T and the MGs, Etta James, Johnny Ace, and Bojangle tap dancing is just as beautiful as anything that happened anywhere else in the world. Teach them that anywhere people go, they have experience, and that all experience is art. And on top of just the very fun interweaving of jokes in the context of the book and kind of a sincere, hey, if anyone who's reading this is sure that their version of hoodoo is more true than mine, please accept this. There is also a kind of hyper-real plea that, you know, African-American experience is not some degraded version of white American. The art that comes out of it, that jazz is not some corrupted classical music, that blues is not just, you know, it's not just four chords and a soul. It is all of these things, just like all of classical music, European classical music, is just people playing with math. All of these things are art. All of these things are valuable. And even when the book is not doing these crazy pastiche moments, even when it is just kind of a moment of real appreciation of the Western as a genre, as is later on, I don't have a physical copy of the book, but I presume either the same page or the next page. He removed some shiny black boots which hung near a colony of bats. On each boot was painted the emblem of a yellow chicken. He tried on a black fedora. Hanging above the altar was a whip made of bull's hide and python skin. It was tough and heavy, and when it flew through the air, it whistled. In another section of the cave, green eyes began to purr. Loop looked at his watch. It was time to feed the black cats prowling about the cave. The two men finished with their meal, lay back, and started to sleep off the food they had so eagerly panhandled. Loop worked on to the morning, mixing potions, chanting poems, making dolls, and burning candles. Now all he needed was a horse. And things only get crazier from that point onward. Just to skip randomly forward and drop you into the middle of another scene, I think actually in the middle of some dialogue. Town 50 miles from here, the kids were found in caves smoking Indian tobacco, and the herd drag sent up the Chisholm was stampeded by giant sloths, which is crazy as hell, Big Lizzie, because giant sloths haven't lazed around the plains of North America for thousands of years. Sometimes I think the whole continent is accursed. The preacher, Reverend Boyd, is going around like a town kook. Nobody goes to his church anymore, and he's weaving some kind of allegorical prophecies. The preacher, Reverend Boyd, entered the bar and through his three-week-old beard began to recite from a yellow pad attached to a clipboard. He reeled about the room. Stomp me, O Lord, I am the theoretical mother of all insects. Mash my 21 or so body segments. Tear the sutures which join my many abdomens. Make me a mass of stains of thy choice. An ugly blotch under thy big funny clodhoppers. The door swung open on the last line. The men seated dropped their poker cards and slowly moved away from their chairs. The moose got to its feet and clomped through the side of the building, sending splinters of wood flying. Here you're looking for me, Marshal. Big Lizzie, Skinny McCullough, and the bartender eased away from the bar. The other cowpokes froze. Now, kid, the Marshal said, what's a Western without tall tales and gaudy romance? Have a drink. Pretending to reach for his change, the Marshal drew his shooting iron. Too bad. Too slow. Not fast enough. The lash whistled through the room and popped off the marshal's holster. A second lash flipped the gun from his hand, and a third lash cracked off the marshal's hat, a fourth lash unbuckling his belt with its persuader, which caused the marshal's pants to fall and came within a thousandth of an inch of his shirt, unpinning the star, which dropped to the floor. The moose peeked in through the big hole he had made in the wall, but seeing no improvement in the situation, galloped towards a lake in the distance. Loop Guru, the lord of the lash, walked over to the end of the bar where the preacher was crouched on the floor. He was scribbling furiously on his yellow pad. When he saw the loop standing over him, Reverend Boyd brought forth his crucifix. Nothing happened. He took out a pocket mirror and aimed it into Loop's face. Loop used the opportunity to straighten his fedora, which had slid to the side of his head when he gave the marvel such a good behind whipping. "Finished?" Loop asked. The preacher backed away a few paces with a dipshit grin on his face. Loop lashed the crucifix from his breast without tearing into the man's flesh. The crucifix dropped to the floor and the little figure attached to it scrambled into the nearest moose hole. "Didn't you say something about spade poets having gone up in tinder when I walked into the party the other night? Come on, preacher, don't start your thing. I don't want to hear anything about Matthew chapter and verse and diddy bop talk. I get sick of souls sometimes." "All right then," Loop said. Crack. Whenever you say something like that, crack, crack. In the future, check out some sources. Crack, crack, motherfucker. Crack, crack. Ask your mama. Crack. Your wife. Crack, crack. Guillaume Apollinaire. Crack, pop, crinkle, snap. Anybody you want to ask. Crack. But get your information right next time. Nick! Okay? And there you have the name dropping of Guillaume Apollinaire. Not usually the kind of figure you would expect to be referenced in a satire of the Western genre. Now, I am not a scholar of the arts. I am not a follower of Dada or of surrealism in the visual arts by any great detail. But when I read this book a few weeks ago, I went down this massive rabbit hole and learned that Guillaume Apollinaire, if not the coiner of the term, was one of the major definers of the term Orphic as a descriptor of art in general. The specific quote that I think is the reason that Guillaume Apollinaire is pretty relevant to this book as a whole, even if I don't quite grasp the full breadth of its meaning, of the reference, the meaning of his of the reference to him in this exact moment, is that Guillaume Apollinaire described Orphism as an artistic style as the art of painting new totalities with elements that the artist does not take from visual reality but creates entirely by himself. An Orphic painter's works should convey an untroubled aesthetic pleasure but at the same time a meaningful structure and sublime significance. So, in the context of abstract modern art, you're looking at things like post-cubism, you're looking at things like Vasily Kandinsky, or some of the even more abstract forms of surrealism that are the kind of thing that are simultaneously interpretable as landscape art and portraiture, or as cityscapes and vegetation. But even just the most abstract, just blocks of color kinds of thing. And in the case of this book, I think there's a lot of that kind of taking the tokens, taking the color of various words from various different contexts and cultures and jargons and mixing them together to create scenes which don't make sense when trying to put them into a particular historical period, because Meriwether Lewis and his partner Clark show up later in the book. Again, there's a helicopter in the very opening of the novel there. There are all sorts of historical figures who appear in the book who, you know, were separated by hundreds of years. There are all sorts of conversations that happen where clearly one of the characters is talking way over the head of the other, but they are still able to complete the conversation because this is a book. You suspend your disbelief for one thing, why not suspend your disbelief for the whole thing? And I think that that general aesthetic is one that, it again, having only read this and Mumbo Jumbo, I imagine Ishmael Reed carries throughout the rest of his work, but at the very least is definitely important and propulsive in his early work, and I think is a very important aspect of interpreting and appreciating Thomas Pynchon's work. And that's why I brought this book to the podcast today, is that while as much as I love Pynchon, having continued to co-host this show and planning to at least for the next couple of years do so with Against the Day, I do think that in terms of capturing that particular aspect of postmodern literature, I think that Ishmael Reed's work does an incredible job of framing that pastiche as something that can be simultaneously ridiculous and silly and fun and lighthearted and colorful, while also being deadly serious and dark and politically motivated and religiously and philosophically informed, while doing all of the previous things at the same time. And that's where so much of the discussion of Thomas Pynchon is obscured by the expertise of the published authors, because, hey, you know, they understand his antecedents as an author. They understand where the inspiration to have a scene like the banana breakfast in Gravity's Rainbow would come from. And so they don't feel the need to discuss these kinds of things. And I think that something that Ishmael Reed, being one of the very late members of the Harlem Renaissance, and some people would argue the thread that kickstarted the new Harlem Renaissance, as it's talked about these days, is that he was interested far more in being appreciated by the uneducated everyman, even if realistically he had to be aware that most people who weren't interested in high art with a capital A were not going to just stumble across his books and read them. And if they did, I'm sure they were bettered for it. But what Pynchon's work does, what Ishmael Reed's work does, is by being so formally experimental and so unself-serious while still keeping their eyes as authors on the ball of actual social relevance, it allows the reader, and I imagine so many people who listen to our show appreciate this about Pynchon. Hopefully some of you will begin to appreciate that about Ishmael Reed's work. These are avenues into those more important forms of academia, right? Whether it's Thomas Pynchon talking about flight mechanics and information technology infrastructure in Bleeding Edge, or historiography in The Crying of Lot 49 and various other books of his, or it's Ishmael Reed's discussion of fine art movements and poetry, and both of their discussion of music and jazz in particular. I think that the way that they interweave these themes into the text of the works are such an important part of both of their values as artists. And I think that the fact that Pynchon has this very small but pretty strong fan base through today, but Ishmael Reed is relegated to kind of just he's a social author. Oh, he's an experimental black author, I think is incredibly reductive for Reed's sake, because as Pynchon references explicitly in Gravity's Rainbow, Mumbo Jumbo is an incredibly effective depiction of the ways that social movements are subverted and captured by pre-existing social structures and power structures. And I have probably a solid 20 minutes more worth of quotes in this very short book that wouldn't even, again, like I said at the very beginning, breach the best moments of the book. I think that I've made my points with regard to selling the book. So at this point, to my other co-hosts, I open the floor. Do you have any questions? Do you have any thoughts? Do you have any similar recommendations for our listeners?
I remember you mentioning this when it was a few weeks ago. Well, however long ago it was, because I don't remember. Towards the end of Bleeding Edge, I think, is when you mentioned it. But it definitely piqued my interest, especially having read Mumbo Jumbo. And I think part of what there was a lot I really loved about that book. Part of it was that it felt the most like reading what jazz sounds like, if that makes sense. His prose and his storytelling approach in that book, at least, I'm curious if it's the same in this one. It sounds like it certainly is. It has this sort of manic energy that can seem like it is presenting a cohesionless mess of ideas and themes and plot. But when you really take the time to engage with it and really let it tell the story that it's telling in the way that it's telling it and meet it at that level and really, you know, let it do its work, it becomes this phenomenal thing. Much like with jazz, it can sound to a lot of people like noise and, you know, this atonal mess at times. But if you really engage with it and really allow it to work its magic, you can really find what the artist is getting at there. And it sounds like I mentioned, it sounds like this is kind of the same thing, especially being that this is the book that preceded Mumbo Jumbo. It seems like this, he's definitely getting his structure in that and everything. So I'm really excited to read it. It is incredibly hard to find. I've been looking for it since you mentioned it on that previous episode, and I haven't had any luck finding, like, tracking down a decent copy of it. I don't want to go through Amazon just for reasons. So I've just been kind of browsing through, like, Better World Books and Abe Books and just kind of keeping an eye out for it. So I'm going to have to resume that search again, because I'm, again, very excited to read this one.
Yeah. In many ways, this book, I think, is more accessible to people who are not familiar with, or at least comfortable with, the more explicitly experimental kinds of writing. Mm-hmm. Because in Mumbo Jumbo, there are embedded images in this novel. There are footnotes, often, you know, it's not Infinite Jest, it's not, you know, Tristram Shandy, but there are footnotes, and it is a much more hypertextual book. This is, it could have been a radio play. It would have been a very strange one, but you could just read the entire book out and it would get the same point across. There would be no loss in terms of format. And so in some ways, I think that you could view Mumbo Jumbo as a better or more refined form of this kind of writing, but it's also, I'll have to revisit Mumbo Jumbo because I've only read it the once and it's been a while, but I wouldn't be surprised if it's just a plainly better work in many ways. But at the very least, if you're somebody who's familiarity with these kinds of very caustic social issues is one that is significantly eased by comedy. If you're somebody who wouldn't sit down and watch a serious documentary on the darker sides of the civil rights movement, for example, but will watch a Spike Lee movie or Blazing Saddles in a very, very distant, you know, kind of way, then I would say this is a better entry point into the world of Ishmael Reed. But they are very similar in that general aesthetic and that general sense of, as you said, that jazziness, which in the context of Pynchon, people often talk about jazz as a euphemism for his approach to meter in his prose. In the case of Ishmael Reed, at least these books, it is it is that more pre-jazz. It is more of that formally, truly experimental approach because, mm-hmm. you know, in Against the Day and in Mason and Dixon and Gravity's Rainbow, there's so much experimentation going on, but it is transparent. You can read the book straight and still get what's going on. If you try to read this book straight as though it were a classic realist novel or classic romance novel, your brain might stop functioning in terms of comprehending the words. Mm-hmm. This is a book that you do have to be willing to recontextualize at any given moment. And it's a beautiful example of the comedic ability that gives, because people talk about randomness and that kind of freeform nature as something that undercuts humor or undercuts these serious topics. And both Pynchon and this book do very well at is demonstrating that randomness doesn't undercut those things if you take the jokes and you take the randomness seriously. But at the same time, you can sit down and read this book in particular and many of Pynchon's books and Mumbo Jumbo to a maybe lesser extent than this one. You can just read them as fun while recognizing that if you chose to, you could focus on the very serious aspects.
Yeah, yeah.
One of the big things that if you look up this book, you will find is that the Pope appears, and it is not the Pope that would have been contemporaneous to either the writing of the book or any conceivable previous time setting. It is essentially a random pope who is thematically relevant, but I'm not going to get into any of that. I only bring it up to say that if you, like me, love the deep religious theological discussions in literature, this is a book that has plenty of it. About the last 10 pages are 80-90% just the Pope and the Loop Guru kid going back and forth in a very well-written, very intense, dramatic, and also academic dialogue. It's a fascinating blend of all those things together.
Hmm.
Outside of not reading it straight, to kind of use your phrase, is there any other recommendations you have for people on how to read this book because of the inherent sort of challenge or difficulty in its experimentation?
The challenge of reading this book is more a challenge to use the Western metaphor. The challenge of holding on while still going with the bucking of the bronco, right?
Mm.
It's not going to challenge you to understand everything that's referenced. And mm-hmm. part of the reason that I have not tried to make a case for this book's thematic content and that I've stayed so much on the aesthetic of it mm-hmm. is that that's the level that I am familiar enough with the content to engage with. There is a lot of stuff in American, North and South Caribbean, voodoo and hoodoo that I don't know enough about to even start to speak on. There is so much about arts in general, whether it's poetry or visual arts or, you know, the earlier Harlem Renaissance authors that I don't know enough about to capture even when they're being referenced. And that's the impressive part about reading this book is that it's almost like every phrase could be viewed as a piece of a mosaic that when you zoom in, is a whole other picture. So it's one that I don't think is challenging in any way except for it is genuinely heretical. It is genuinely there is real racism in this book, not from mm-hmm. the standpoint of the author or the narrative, but from the standpoint of the characters. There is real misogyny from the characters and some would say the author. There is some real hatred on display. There is hatred from oppressors to the oppressed. There is hatred from the oppressed to the oppressor. That is where the difficulty of this book will come from. Mumbo Jumbo, you're going to find some more technically confusing things. But this book, if you are willing to go with it, you don't need to do preparation for it. You don't need to know much about anything. Although those last 10 pages where the Pope and the Loop Guru kid are arguing about basically the syncretic nature of Catholicism and voodoo as counterpoints, I think might go over most people's heads. A lot of it certainly went over mine. But I don't think it's necessary to do any real preparation to appreciate it.
Okay. Is there any other works that come to mind that you would recommend in conjunction with this one? Like if somebody has either read this book and is looking for something that kind of hits the same flavor, or is just looking for something that maybe can help build towards reading this book, does anything come to mind?
Frankly, no. I mean, again, there's a lot in the realm of visual arts and a lot in the world of like modernist literature that is reminiscent of a lot of the things that happen in this book. But I couldn't honestly give any direction there.
Fair.
Like I said, I am not prepared to talk about this book's political meaning other than saying that it might have convinced me that a voodoo anarchism is the way to go, although some of the historical examples might deter me from, you know, joining in on a real revolution with that as the vanguard.
Sure.
But no, I honestly can't, especially if you are listening to this podcast, almost certainly you are a fan of Thomas Pynchon's work. I can't.
Oh, one would hope so.
Yeah. Because, I mean, there's a reason that Pynchon literally says to anyone who hasn't read it in Gravity's Rainbow, go read Mumbo Jumbo. Because they are on the same wavelength. One of them is white and, you know, more New England-y in a very deep way.
Waspy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But otherwise, they're very much in sync in terms of historical movements in the arts. I can't recommend anything. And if anyone listening does have any recommendations, please send them along. I'd love to read them.
Yeah.
A further request from the listener. If anyone knows how to find the freelance pallbearers...
Oh, yeah, that's his first one, right? That's, like, impossible to find. Okay,
I love that title so much. I loved it the first time you said it on the show. I love it now.
Yep, it's a good one.
Yeah, all of his book's titles are awesome in that way. And I, if anyone listening has a secret stash of them, please send them to the P.O. box in the show notes.
I guess my last question, too, would be, is there anything else from Ishmael Reed that you have read?
I have read a couple of essays and some of the poetry, but okay. I am not even well familiarized with his work in a surface level way. This is very much a very extensive advertisement for this novel.
Gotcha. Yeah, the reason I ask is because he has one... that's like a trial of Lin-Manuel Miranda in if I understand it correctly, it's like a fake court case about his handling of the American founding through the lens of Hamilton and is at the same time like commenting on both the like pro and anti Hamilton camps that were in like the cultural sort of disposition at the time. It seems very fascinating and like ultra contemporary in a way that is like almost surprising that it exists and got published.
Yeah, my understanding is that he has stayed up to date with pop culture and that all of his ridiculous pastiche debates in this book carry through to all of his newer writings as well.
Mm.
Now, I have seen in reading some of the reviews of this book from contemporary to us people, there were quite a few people who had less than good things to say on how his politics have developed over the course of his career. While I can say that the Ishmael Reed who wrote this book and wrote Mumbo Jumbo I am sure would write a both scathing and also respectable criticism and discussion of Lin-Manuel Miranda's work. I could also totally, I would also not at all be surprised if it were in some ways a more regressive discussion of things. Mm. I don't know, though. That's pure speculation.
It is interesting that a book like that exists at all, that's for sure.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, the fact that he published things like that are part of why I have decided that I'm going to try to get through as many of his works as I can. The only reason that I decided it would be a good idea to cover this book is that, A, knowing that Blazing Saddles is still a very popular work, knowing that this Yellowback Radio Broke Down was written, you know, 10 years before that, I'm pretty confident that most people who picked up this book, who had the stomach for some of the less savory aspects, would enjoy it. And I honestly just couldn't come up with anything else to talk about, because I loved this book, and it really stuck with me for the past like month. So yeah, it's the fact that he is still writing and that he is still as angry as he was when he was a young man is indicative that at least he is a passionate artist, which, if anyone listening remembers anything I said about Saltburn a year or so ago now,
yeah,
you'll understand. That's what I create art on, is how passionate the creators are.
Sure.
Well, that is the end of my very extended advertisement for this 60-year-old novel. Thank you all for listening to Mapping the Zone. Thank you for bearing with us through our extended leave from covering the books of Thomas Pynchon. But we greatly appreciate your continuing to at least stay subscribed to our podcast, and hopefully you enjoy these last few bonus episodes we've recorded. Now, at the time, we don't know what'll be coming next, but I imagine there will be something between this and our coverage of Against the Day. But if not, know that we appreciate you regardless, and thank you, and goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.